Recording in progress.
I call this meeting of the Committee on Children's and Families to order. And we indeed do have a quorum, which is very relevant because we have some bills today. It's going to be a good time. So, can I get a motion on the minutes from the last meeting?
So moved.
Representative Vice Chair Hansen moves the minutes from February 11th, 2025. Is there any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. So, everybody's very excited. We are going to hear our first bills as a committee today. It is going to be a good time where we are civil and respectful. I'd like to remind everyone that be civil, be respectful. We might vehemently disagree, but we can disagree without being disagreeable. So I will move to refer House File 22 to the Education Policy Committee. So the bill is before us. What is Gilman?
Yes, she's here.
So Representative Gilman, please join us at the testifier table.
Good afternoon. So again, my name is Representative Don Gilman. I'm happy to bring forward House File 22. What this bill?
I understand you have an author's amendment.
Yes, I do. I'd like to offer the A1 amendment.
You're not allowed. You're not on the committee.
Oh, I'm not. Thank you.
So I will move you the A1 amendment. If you could just give a quick, short synopsis of what the amendment does, and we'll get it adopted so it's how you'd like.
Thank you, Chair West. Yes, so the author's amendment will add a standard of review that requires any violation of parental rights to satisfy the most stringent legal standards. That's what that does.
All right, so we'll just, it's custom that we Representative Coulter, question to the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, I'm obviously not an attorney. I'm wondering, there is a phrase, necessary to achieve a compelling state interest. Could you just explain a little bit what that means and maybe provide some examples?
Representative Gilman.
All right. I'm just curious if one of the stakeholders is in the room right now. But the feedback that I got is that legally this is what would need to be put into this bill to have that standard, to satisfy the most stringent standard, legal standard. And so I definitely don't want to go into the weeds on what that could be compelling.
Representative Coulter.
I will just say, I mean, it's an author's amendment, and I want to be respectful of that part of the process. It would be helpful to know a little bit more about what, I mean, it's without demonstrating that the potential infringement of parental rights is reasonable and necessary to achieve a compelling state interest. I mean, that seems like it could potentially be a significant change to the bill, and I think it would be helpful to have a little bit more information about what that refers to, but we can move forward.
Representative Coulter, that is courteous of you. Totally understandable. We can have that discussion to that after it's adopted. It's totally reasonable. Okay, so I move the A1 amendment. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? The amendment is adopted. The motion prevails. Now that the bill is in the shape the author would like it, and I would encourage to address Representative Coulter's
yes.
question throughout your presentation. I think that'd be very helpful.
Wonderful. But thank you so much.
Go ahead and get after it. Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair. So House File 22 establishes a broad parental rights to direct the education, upbringing, religious instruction, health, and privacy of a child without government interference. House File 22, as amended, empowers parents to direct their children's education, upbringing, religious instruction, health and privacy of their child without the interference of government at a state or a local level. We need to empower parents with resources to guide their children's upbringing and give them the seat at the table. This bill specifically names the rights to direct the education, whether it be public, charter, private, or home education. Additionally, the bill directs the upbringing, moral, and religious training of a child and have informed consent and health care decisions. Transparency and accountability are pillars of good government, and this bill ensures we are doing just that. This bill does not create new rights, but rather recognizes the rights parents already have. And with that, I thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing this bill.
Thank you, Representative Gilman. We will move on to public testimony on the bill before having a discussion. Is there a particular testifier you would like first?
I'm welcome to however you'd like to call them. Thank you.
All right. I'll invite Alicia LaVisca up to the testifier table to kick us off. Would you please introduce yourself for the record and bring your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Preferable around 2 minutes.
Yes, sir. My name is Alicia LaVisca. I am the mom of three children, ages 9, 10, and 16, and I am here today as the co-director of Minnesotans for Health and Parental Rights. MHPR has been a trusted community for over a decade, bringing together families, healthcare practitioners, legal professionals, educators, child care providers, and business owners. What began as a grassroots support group is now a broader movement as we encountered more families facing unexpected challenges. Can the committee please note that we have submitted written testimony titled HF22 MHPR Written Testimony. For generations, parental rights were considered a given and a fundamental principle guiding families and society. It was widely understood that parents are most invested, best equipped, and most reasonable individuals to make decisions for their minor children, raising them according to their values and cultural traditions. The principle shaped legal and societal norms for centuries. However, in 2000, the Supreme Court's split decision in Troxell versus Granville opened the door for individual judges and states to apply their own interpretations of parental rights. This has led to inconsistency, confusion, and lack of stability for families seeking to fulfill their role as a primary decision makers in their children's lives. Our oral and written testimony today reflects the experiences of countless parents and professionals who have turned to us for help navigating these challenges. Many were invited to testify here today in person, but were too fearful of the potential consequences of sharing their stories publicly. We appreciate the opportunity to share the voices and underscore the importance of strong families as the foundation of strong communities. And to remain respectful of this committee's time, I would like to again point out that we have submitted testimony in writing, which contains more than 15 accounts from families that would be important to this committee's discussion on this issue. Additionally, we receive feedback from both education and healthcare professionals who have expressed significant concern about the growing challenges they face in balancing institutional policies with the rights of parents and families. Those concerns are also outlined in our testimony. In conclusion, the experiences shared in the testimony, which has been submitted to this committee, highlight the urgent need for the Parents' Bill of Rights to provide clear, consistent protection for parents and families across Minnesota by ensuring that parental rights are firmly established and respected. We can foster stronger communities where families have the support and autonomy to make the best decisions for their children. A Parents' Bill of Rights will not only safeguard the role of parents, but also help educators, healthcare providers, and other professionals navigate their responsibilities with confidence, ultimately benefiting everyone in Minnesota. And thank you for the opportunity to share these concerns and advocate for a stronger, more supportive framework for families across the state. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. LaVisca. We're gonna roll through public testimony, and then if you have any questions for a specific testifier, feel free to request them by name, and I am certain they will come up. Thank you for testifying. We'll move on to Christine Truin.
Christine.
Thank you, Ms. Druin. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
All right. Members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Christine Troyan. I'm the founder and executive director of Minnesota Parents Alliance. We are a homegrown organization that exists to educate and empower Minnesota parents to be strong advocates for achievement, equality, and parental rights. Members, parents belong in every place where decisions about their children are being made. And I invite you to consider that at no other time in our history has this fundamental truth been called into question until very recently, as the rise of gender activism and critical theory have overtaken policy discussions and decision making. Consider that our schools are routinely responsible for minor students for more waking hours of the day than their parents or legal guardian. This is an unfortunate necessity for many working parents. The opportunities for staff to run afoul of parents' federally protected rights and overstep their role by becoming a decision maker in the child's life are plenty. As someone who has invested countless hours listening to the experiences of parents statewide for the last 3 years, I'm here to tell you that the overstepping and the flagrant violations of parents' rights are happening with alarming frequency in K-12 education. The need for legislative clarification and protections have never been more clear. You may hear from other testifiers about the fact that parents are currently excluded from their child's health care records and patient and physician conversations at 13, which is absurd, but it's even more upsetting when you consider the fact that against the backdrop of the rapid increase of school-based health clinics and expansion for full-service community schools across Minnesota. As you should already know, the state and federal funding for these initiatives has exponentially increased over the last 5 years, and dozens of districts across Minnesota have now opened fully functional school-based health clinics on campus, with more in the pipeline. Adopting full-service community programs and dispensing mental health and physical health care during school hours invites conflicts, data privacy violations, and conflation of roles by well-intentioned but misguided staff. Minnesota would be wise to reject the blurring of lines between education and health care with the introduction of these ever-growing wraparound services. And we need only to look to states like California and Maine, where these programs were rapidly implemented and the age of consent for health care was lowered to as low as 12. As a cautionary tale for these initiatives with disastrous consequences. The language of House File 22 establishes a foundational understanding and guiding principles for policymakers as they navigate decisions about how or whether these types of initiatives move forward. It's essential that steps are taken this session to safeguard our children and the rights of Minnesota parents to protect and advocate for them to the fullest extent. This is an opportunity for the adults in the room to cut through the noise of cultural fads, flawed academic theories, and the pervasive lobbying efforts of teachers' unions and other special interests that politically and financially profit from Frankenstein programs that experiment with combining education and medical and mental health treatments and redirect public dollars for K-12 education into private for-profit service providers. Let's commit to putting safeguards in place to ensure that basic fundamental rights and responsibilities of parents are respected and remain paramount in every realm of public policy. Minnesotans of all backgrounds and beliefs are watching with great interest to see who in this decision-making body could possibly be opposed to the common sense protections laid out in this bill. Thank you so much for showing up and listening and serving the parents of this great state.
Thank you, Ms. Truitt. Next up on the list is Karen Miller. Welcome to the committee. Would you state your name for the record?
Yes, my name is Karen Miller. Thank you, Chair West, members of the committee, and thank you most of all to Representative Gilman and all those who have worked so hard to bring this parental bill of rights to the committee today. My name is Karen Miller. I'm a wife, mother of six, teacher, and author of Faith in Action, a Substack publication. Early on in our parenting journey, my husband and I chose homeschooling. We realized that it simply was a natural extension of the nurture we were already showing our young children. In the same way we taught them to care for their bodies, we could also nurture their minds by teaching them the sounds and symbols of our language and the numeric concepts and patterns in the world around us. So homeschooling allowed us to do this in a manner consistent with our biblical worldview, for the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. And it gave us the flexibility to do so in a manner that best fit their diverse learning styles, from a child who learned to read on her own to one who was severely dyslexic. We are incredibly grateful for the support of our parental rights that allowed us to make these educational choices on behalf of our children, which has been the key to their success. And we are not alone in making this decision. Parents have also chosen homeschooling for nearly 30,000 children across the state of Minnesota. So I encourage us all right now to just take a pause and take a big step back and consider the big picture of parental rights. biological reality itself teaches us that every child has a right to a mother and a father. Each child is derived from their DNA, born of the mother's body, and delivered into their waiting arms. Thus, the parent-child relationship is a sacred bond that must be protected. The right of parents to care for and direct the upbringing of their children in every aspect is a sacred trust. Yet, in Minnesota's classrooms and halls of medicine, we are seeing policies and practices that undermine the sacred bond and seek to influence vulnerable minor children apart from their parents' knowledge or consent. No doctor, teacher, or government agent should ever infringe upon the sacred parent-child relationship. So it is time for the state of Minnesota to explicitly codify into law protections for inalienable parental rights. There is no better gift we could give to the children of this state, no better safeguard for their well-being and future.
Ms. Miller, I hate interrupting, but... yeah,
okay. There is no better gift we could give to the children of this state, no better safeguard for their well-being and future. Empowering parents is the key to thriving children. Vote in favor of the Parents' Bill of Rights and watch our future generations soar. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Ms. Miller. Next on the list is Meg Luger-Nikolai. If you come to the table and introduce yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Meg Luger-Nikolai. I'm an attorney with Education Minnesota, where we represent 85,000 school professionals who dedicate their working lives to educating kids and keeping them safe. Unfortunately, this bill appears geared toward making their efforts harder, something that I scarcely thought was possible. Schools educate children on a variety of topics, and Minnesota already has an opt-out law that permits parents to prevent their children from receiving some information if they wish. That is Minnesota Statute 120B.20. This bill makes no distinction between the act of teaching and whatever a reader may conceive of as interference with parental rights. How would a teacher ever know if they are directing the upbringing of a child or just providing behavioral support in a classroom? This bill could subject members of my organization to summary termination and other discipline merely for doing their jobs. It also puts school administrators, in whom members of this committee typically put a great deal of trust, to create and adopt local curriculum similarly at risk. This bill will also make kids less healthy. Schools perform routine vision and hearing screenings. That's how they know a kiddo might need glasses. And usually it's on an opt-out basis. This bill would make that illegal. An administrator will tell you that requiring an opt-in will depress the amount of students who participate. And so students who have hearing and visual differences that could impact their learning and their personal safety will be without this very inexpensive but valuable service. This also makes students or any children who are in CHIPS proceedings less safe. Currently, Minnesota Statute 260C.201 permits judges to entrust to non-parent guardians decision-making for a child who is the victim of severe abuse or neglect. This bill could prevent a judge from doing that, leaving the child at the whim of abusive or neglectful parents whose rights this bill appears to elevate over the personal safety of a child, because it adds a new burden of proof for judges, and that couldn't be more true with the addition of the language offered in the author amendment today. I appreciate that there's a savings clause for ending a life or murder of a child, but I think we can do better by kids. I suspect that this bill is the result of a sad, complicated, and probably unique family situation, and it is not as common as asserted. I hope that that family finds healing, but it would be wrong to leverage that sad story in a way to make kids harder to protect, harder to educate, and harder to keep out of harm's way. So we recommend a no vote on this bill. Thanks.
Thank you, Ms. Nikolai. Next on the list, Rebecca Delahunt. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Chair West, Representative Gilman, and members, thank you for having me today. My name is Rebecca Delahunt, and I work as the Director of Public Policy with Minnesota Family Council. Minnesota Family Council represents tens of thousands of families in our state, and we support the values behind House File 22. We receive calls from constituents regularly, and one of the most common requests for support we receive are from parents. Parents are concerned about their own children being victimized by non-related adults overstepping authority and making decisions for the child. This overstep of authority is typically coming from a non-related adult in a place of authority. Could be a teacher, a school administrator, or a medical professional pushing an adult agenda on a child. Although these adults may be experts in their field, that adult is not raising the child. Minnesota statutes account for situations in which a parent abuses his or her child, and those statutes guide the state on guiding the child to safety. As a testifier previously said before me, we certainly don't want to put children in more safety or in more danger. Government protects those who cannot protect themselves, so when legislators draft public policy on education and health care, the guiding question must be, are we protecting children or are we victimizing them? For most children, the safest ultimate authority is the care and upbringing of their own parents. The Supreme Court has long held that parents have a fundamental right to the care and upbringing of their own children because it's the safest place for children. A child's rights to his or her own parents predates governmental authority, and it reflects the history and tradition of this country and its jurisprudence. This bill is a step in the right direction of pro-child public policy for Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Delahunt. Next on the list is Dory Trossen. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
My name is Dory Trossen. I'm a mother of two wonderful children. And I'm here today to request you consider a yes vote on this parental rights bill. When my son was just 1 year old, he got sick with just a regular stomach bug that required hospitalization for hydration. During that time, we were in the early stages of diagnosis of a rare autoimmune disease called mast cell activation syndrome. While he was in their care, I explained what he needed in regards to different foods that were different than typical. Sorry, I'm a little shaky. This is like a personal testimony. And I tried to inform them that we were in between working with our primary care physician and getting to the specialist to help get him the help that he needed. While we were there, it started out as a good experience, but it turned south when they decided that he needed to go on a dairy-based formula to help him with his nutrition. You would look at these pictures here. This picture here is actually before they put him on the formula. And these are the pictures after. You think when you bring your child into a hospital setting to help them, they are going to come out looking better and not worse. It was 8 days of protocols not being followed when it comes to allergic reactions. It was 8 days I watched my child suffer. It was really, really hard, but I just wanted him to be better. And in the end, after they finally released him from the hospital, with no real change other than the fact, after those 8 days in the hospital, he could no longer absorb full food. He was on medication 16 times a day to keep him alive.
I hate to interrupt, but we are at 2 minutes, if you could.
Okay. And I'm here in support of the parental rights bill because in that situation, we tried to transfer him to a different hospital through an ambulance, and we were refused. They said that they would call CPS on us, and they would take him away. So I ask that you consider a yes vote on this parental rights bill so that no child has to go through what my child had to go through. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Trossen. Next on the list is Jill Grunwald.
Hello. Hello, and thank you for having me. My name is Jill McLaughlin-Grunwald, and I'm the founder of an organization called Protective Parent Coalition. And I started that organization largely due to concerns I have that I will outline today. I do have one child in the public school system, and I also feel like I'm here representing several parents, mostly within my district, parents that I've connected with who have similar concerns that I do, but also other parents in surrounding districts. So there's very much a general anti-parent atmosphere in the district that I'm in, which happens to be St. Louis Park, but as I said, I'm friends with other parents in other districts who feel the same. They claim to want to hear from parents on different issues and how they feel about, you know, what's going on within the walls of the school, but they really don't. They will listen to you and give you lip service, but then nothing changes. There's very much an anti-religious atmosphere in the district. And I think a lot of you probably know about the Somali family situation in St. Louis Park, where, you know, St. Louis Park claims to be, they're always talking about equity and anti-discrimination, but those families were utterly treated with the most horrific disrespect and disregard for their religious beliefs and what was being taught in the St. Louis Park district. I didn't know until recently that there are video monitors in the classroom. There's a huge problem with incident reporting, like when children get hurt or bullied, and the district's not notifying the parents about it. This has been a huge problem in elementary, middle, and the high school. I wrote a letter at the beginning of this school year and submitted it to the school nurse around specific and very reasonable boundaries about what would go on. Excuse me, I'm getting over a cold. At the nurse's office, and I was told, oh, yeah, we'll get back to you. Nobody ever got back to me. I reached out to the principal. I reached out to the assistant principal. No one has ever gotten back to me about that letter. And I have, in general, I have been viewed as difficult because I have exerted my very reasonable parental rights within this district, and they don't want to hear from me, and they don't want to hear from parents like me. So
2 minutes.
Thank you.
You could wrap it up.
Thank you for having me.
Next on the list is William Wagner on Zoom.
Distinguished Chair and distinguished members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to provide the opportunity to provide testimony on House File 22. My name is William Wagner, and I hold the academic rank of Distinguished Professor Emeritus, Constitutional Law. I served on the faculty of the University of Florida, Western Michigan University, Cooley Law School, where I taught constitutional law and ethics for many years, currently hold the Faith and Freedom Center Distinguished Chair at Spring Arbor University. Before joining academia, I served as a federal judge in the United States Courts and Senior Assistant United States Attorney, Department of Justice, and Legal Counsel in the U.S. Senate. More relevant, though, I'm here today as the Vice President of Parental Rights Foundation, and I hope to address briefly the standard of review issue that was raised in the amendment, and also to address the concerns of the person that testified about the bill and child abuse and things like that. So the amendment fixes the proposed statute, in my view, because without that amendment, it would have been applying the wrong constitutional standard for a fundamental right, and especially a fundamental right of parental rights. Both Minnesota case precedent in the Minnesota Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court hold that parental rights are fundamental. And so the statute is correct in addressing this as a fundamental right. Where the previous version before the amendment was incorrect, though, it set a standard of reasonable and prudent scope. That is an incorrect, both under Minnesota and the U.S. Law and the U.S. Constitution. Much more is required. A court applies what's called strict scrutiny when reviewing government actions that interfere with a citizen's fundamental rights, including the fundamental right of a parent that we're discussing today. And I've submitted written testimony that has these U.S. Supreme Court cases and the specific language of the Supreme Court And so I would request be made part of the record as well. Likewise, the Minnesota Supreme Court has held in a parental rights case that this kind of high-level strict scrutiny is the appropriate standard of review, and it did that in the Soho versus Johnson case. Again, that goes into more detail in my written testimony. The amendment fixes the only problem that I had.
I hate to interrupt, but you're at 2 minutes. If you could just wrap up.
Okay, and then the only thing that I would say is that including that correct fundamental rights standard also codifies the correct standard, making Minnesota the 21st state to do so if you pass it. But that correct standard is also the correct standard in child abuse and neglect cases. The state has in every place in the United States where they've enacted this law a compelling interest to protect the child against physical abuse and child neglect. And so it's the correct standard for that as well. And this law does nothing
to
diminish that.
I'm good. Thank you very much. Thank you for your testimony. Is there any other member of the public that would like to testify before the committee on this bill? Go ahead and head on up there. And please introduce yourself for the record.
I do have a testimony online, but I did want to add some things. My name is Nadine Monji. My son was held about 7.5 months in the hospitals. The reasons why was he was in withdrawal in one of the other hospitals, and they decided to report me because of that, because I called it out. There should never be retaliation in these. I have three children, one being severely autistic. The other two are graduated from college. I am a certified medical coder, and I've never seen so much fraud in my life. I worked within fraud, waste, abuse, and error, and I have literally called this out to the medical board, which they do nothing, and also the Department of Health, and they do nothing as well. I've sent multiple letters to them. Despite tons of evidence, nothing is done. My child was put on antipsychotics, and due to him having adverse reactions to medications, I have went to naturopathic, I went to everyone I could, and nobody will help. Now we're in bigger issues because now nobody will treat my child, okay? And after those antipsychotics, I would like you to hear what he sounded like. See if I can get this going here. Oh, sorry. He has never had any respiratory conditions before he entered that hospital, and they pumped him up on medications that were without parental approval. Okay, I did not approve these medications. I've went to the medical board, they do nothing. CPS, and I'm just going to tell you this, neglect is a huge window, okay? It is not apparent that seeking medical outside of the AMA, okay? And when I bring evidence, somebody contact me. I'm an African-American mother, single mother, dealing with a child that's very complex. I need help. I don't need you to take my child, put him in a DHS home where he jumps out of the window several times and ends up at the hospital. And I don't need criminal charges against my child because of that, because I've sought help within the government and trying to get help with him. It's like retaliation all over the place. And our lives have been destroyed.
I hate to interrupt, but yeah,
okay. Well, thank you. And I thank you so much for this. And I hope that you do approve this. God bless.
Are there any other members of the public who would like to testify on House File 22? Any other members? All right. And with that, if you did testify, we invite you to stick around in case any members have questions for you. But we will now move to member discussion on House File 22 as amended. Any member? Vice Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Chair West, and thank you, Representative Gilman. I do a lot of work in child protection, so I'm going to ask you a series of questions just so I can understand kind of why we're in this particular chapter of law. So can you help me understand why you chose 260C to start with?
Representative Gilman.
Thank you so much, Chair, and thank you, Representative Hansen. The reason this bill has been brought forward and brought to you all today is not only constituents in my area where I represent, but just many throughout the state have been asking for in Minnesota state law to have this codified into state law based on the Supreme Court decisions. So again, going back to it being a fundamental right of parents to be a part of conversations. And we got to hear many examples today, but I know many of you out there have different experiences in your area. Again, as a parent, locking arms with teachers and with our education and also mental, just from the mental aspect to having things brought forward through medical things as well, that parents ultimately need to be a part of that decision, and they've been left out of the equation. So that's why this has been brought forward.
Vice Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for that answer. Unfortunately, I heard the testimony, and I understand where you're coming from philosophically. My question specifically is legislatively, why did you choose 260C as the place to put this particular provision in your proposal?
If you'd like to respond to that, but we don't want to be repetitive in our questioning. So go ahead, Representative Gilman.
Again, I don't want to be repetitive, and I do want to answer questions, but as this moves through, I'm open to any and all conversations. And if you have expertise, like you're talking about with Children Protective Services, I'd be open to suggestions as well as this moves through the process.
Vice Chair Hansen, I assume there is a specific reason for the question, so please help us.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Gilman. And I just wanted to ask, I think it's important that we lead with curiosity, and so I wanted to see if you had a particular reason for why you chose this chapter of law to draft this bill under. What I'm gathering is that I can help understand kind of what this statute does, and so I'm willing to do that. Under 260C.001, it defines what the intent of this section is, which this is the juvenile protection provisions of the Juvenile Court Act, which is, you know, for a child in need of protective services, permanency matters, termination of parental rights, post-termination reviews, and finalizing adoptions. And you know, obviously, when we're talking about child protection, you know, the kind of overarching theme in the child protection world is that the paramount consideration in all juvenile protection is proceedings is the health, safety, and best interests of the child. And so given that the statute you chose is in child protection, it's my interpretation that what you're proposing would actually only apply in child protection proceedings. And I don't think, based on the testimony nor your comments, that that's your intention. But I do want to kind of understand why you chose 260C, and that's why I'm asking these questions. Is there a reason that you did not draft this under, like, 120 or 257 or 363 or 517 to 519? I think there's a number of other places in our statutes where this could apply and not kind of cause that confusion that it's only applying in situations of child protection.
Representative Gilman.
Again, I will be open to any and all conversations around where this should ultimately end up landing, but this is where we were starting. So thank you.
Jet, I'm just going to quick ask a clarifying question because it seems like when studying specific statute, house research could be handy here. Vice Chair Hansen's statement that this only comes into play in those situations, is that in the realm of accurate?
Mr. Chair and members, putting this in Chapter 260C doesn't necessarily mean that it would only apply to CHIPS cases or something like that, but there are rights in here that are scattered throughout statute. So my assumption is, and I wasn't involved in drafting this bill, but my assumption is it was chosen as a sort of place to bring it all together. But I don't know necessarily that it has the effect of coding it here likely does not have the effect of making it only apply in CHIPS cases.
Thank you, Ms.
Sunderman. But it's not entirely clear.
Vice Chair Hanson.
Thank you, and that's really helpful, and that's what I wanted to get to the kind of root of here, is because that's a lot of the questions I'm receiving are about that. And so I'll just make a few more comments about a few other pieces of this that I think you could take back and potentially change if you feel like it would be appropriate. There's a few places in here where you redefine parents and child, which that's also already defined in the statute. I think it's really important to recognize that the definition of parents is actually quite more extensive than what you have in your provisions here. And so I would look back at in 260C.009 and 007, where we have longer definitions that may provide inclusivity for more than what you've listed here. I'm also concerned about the concept of moral training a little bit. I worry that as you move forward, that this could be interpreted as, we heard from Ms. Luger-Nicolai, that there's potentially, you know, we're limiting teachers from teaching kids basic things like manners or teamwork or to look both ways before they cross the street. I think that's important to consider, that we do rely on teachers to help reinforce some of the things that we tell our kids, especially when there's an opportunity for that to happen. So if they're crossing the street for a field trip, that message we put in their heads as parents may be there, but I think reinforcing that there is important too. And so I think clarifying what moral training means is pretty important here, including, you know, how to call 911 if they need to. There's all sorts of things that schools and other adults in our kids' lives reinforce. I also am curious about how we would enforce this. There's no appropriation here, and I would imagine that education, health, a lot of the other professions that would be affected by this are going to need to enforce it. And I don't know how they would do that, given that there's a lot of restraints already. So I think addressing enforcement and how you expect or would like for it to be enforced would be critical as well. And then the last thing I'll say, Chair, actually one more piece before I say my last thing. I am concerned about what happens in situations of split parents and whose parents' morality wins in this. I've talked about this a lot, but I'm a single mom, and I have de facto full legal and physical custody of my children, but their fathers are on their birth certificates. And so I think I would never want their fathers to be making decisions for them, and I think a lot of people would may feel that way in some situations like mine. And so I think you need to address that. You need to be sure that you are addressing what kind of custody there would be, because I don't see that addressed here either. And then the last piece I will say, and I would like for you to respond to this piece particularly, is I am really concerned about the two-parent consent necessary for things like healthcare decisions for a few reasons. 27% of sexual abuse cases come from somebody that's, you know, in our cases in 2022, and oftentimes that's from somebody related to the child. Whether that's an uncle or a cousin or somebody in the family, that's like the most predominant cases we see. And if there is a parent who is wanting to cover for that family member and not allow healthcare facilities to do the necessary testing that would prompt and allow criminal proceedings to begin, this may, and I'm certain and I'm confident for the record that this is not your intention, but this may provide cover for people who are abusing children. And depending on how that relationship with the other, with the parent or what that parent is deciding. So I would like to hear about how you expect this law to protect kids who are being abused by a family member and with a parent who may be covering for them, which is pretty common.
I appreciate the respectful nature of the way that question was asked. Representative Gilman.
Yes. Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Hanson. So what line are you referring to when you talk about two parents, just so I'm not digging through?
Vice Chair Hanson.
Thank you, Chair. It's really in your entire bill where it talks about parents. I think, like you say, parents get a choice with an S in the plural. I'm a parent, right? There are no parents for my kids. And that's important to note, because what also happens in situations where they're divorced, so if they have joint legal physical custody, obviously, in that statute, it says that those adults are to make moral and religious and healthcare decisions together. But what happens when they're in conflict
That's the piece that you're asking about, and I'm happy to answer any other questions you have or however I can help clarify.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you so much, Chair, and thank you, Representative Hansen. Again, in regards to criminal activity, this is not to provide cover for any criminal activity happening to the minor child. Again, this is to lock arms with healthcare professionals, our teachers, those that are serving our children. And again, we can look at definitions in other statutes on parenting, like on parents. What is the definition of a parent? And I'd be open to that. But we're seeing across, like, nationally, again, there could be different positions that parents do take on the health care for their minor child. And I believe both parents should be a part of the process. Again, if it's been deemed in law already, or a ruling in divorce proceedings, or in that this is the parent, the sole parent, that parent does have that right to make decisions for their child, is what I'm hearing you say, that it would not then go to the biological father. So as this moves through, I'd be open to any and all conversations on where in this law here that you see there would be a cover for some heinous thing happening for children, or creating a space for awful things to happen for a kid. This again goes back to just the inherent right of parents and their relationship with their children, and that the state shouldn't be hopping in and infringing upon those rights.
And one small thing I would add, I don't see anywhere where it says parents where there's not an apostrophe, so it's a possessive, not plural, but maybe I missed it. I just quick took a look through. But Vice Chair Hansen.
Thank you for that, Chair West. The piece that I'm particularly talking about in the consenting before any physical or mental health examinations take place, unless a medical emergency exists, requiring immediate examination to save the life of a minor child, can be found on lines 2.6 to 2.8. Mm-hmm. And what I'm understanding, like, I'll give you a scenario, let's say, and forgive me for the public and for folks listening, this is really graphic stuff that we talk about in this committee because child protection does get that way. And so, for example, if a child is molested by their uncle and they go to the hospital, they tell their mother, mother takes them to the emergency room. It's not life-threatening injuries. The doctors cannot proceed without written consent from the father if the parents are married, in this case, is what I'm understanding you to say. And if that father really does not want his brother convicted of something like this, could that father then say no to the medical examination that would be necessary to collect the evidence to pursue a criminal charge? That's like a scenario to think about in terms of the healthcare question you asked.
Thank you, Vice Chair Hansen. One aspect I'd bring up, 3.7, it does specifically talk about abuse or neglect, and this does not authorize any of that. Meaning, if we are in that space, it is not just going to allow an abuser to run rampant. If we need clarification, we are happy to work collaboratively together, as the Representative Gilman has stated, to refine this if it needs refining, and it's a work in progress. But Representative Gilman, do you have any response, or move on?
We can move on. Thank you, Chair.
All right. Representative Coulter.
Well, thank you, Chair. I wasn't expecting to go right away. I want to be respectful of folks' time, and I want to be respectful of the fact that we don't want to be repetitive in this committee. So I do want to just briefly return, and maybe nonpartisan staff can help me out here. This amendment and the phrase compelling state interest, it would just be really helpful, I think, for me, and I think the public too, to understand, given that in the amendment, in essence, provides an exception. It says that the governmental entity or institution shall not infringe without demonstrating that infringement is reasonable and necessary to achieve a compelling state interest. So basically, the only time an infringement is allowable is if there is a compelling state interest. And I don't know how big of a, for lack of a better term, loophole that is. So I'm wondering if maybe someone from nonpartisan staff could help us out there.
Ms. Sunderman.
Mr. Chair, members, so this is the judicial standard of review, meaning that the court determines what, a reviewing court determines what the compelling state interest is and whether whatever action is being challenged met that standard of review. So it's, I can't give any list of what a compelling state interest might be, but that's a determination for the court upon review.
Thank you, Ms. Sunderman. Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That, as with many things we hear from lawyers, that's not the most satisfying answer, but it's at least a little bit helpful. So turning quickly to the language of the bill here, I'm specifically looking at, and I should apologize for my voice. As a parent of young kids, this is how I sound at the end stage of a cold. But I'm specifically looking at its line, lines 2.2 through 2.4. All parental rights without interference, including the right to, in line 2.3, accept or decline biological, pharmaceutical, and supplemental interventions. And so if this bill were to become law, help me understand this, that this protects, I assume, sort of both sides of that coin. It does not require, it would say that the government cannot force a child to undergo certain medical or biological procedures without parental consent, but it would also protect, so a parent directs a certain course of care for their child, for example, it would protect the parent's right to make that choice. Am I correct in understanding that?
Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair. I was just curious if Will Wagner would be interested in just weighing in on this information here.
Will Wagner via Zoom.
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. It actually goes back as far as you can imagine in U.S. Supreme Court history, but that's the compelling government interest is the standard that is used in fundamental rights cases. In other words, when the right is so important, like freedom of speech or the right of parents to control the upbringing of the children, the U.S. Supreme Court and Minnesota Supreme Court basically says that there's a fundamental right and that you apply strict scrutiny, which is that compelling government interest. Now, what does that mean? The U.S. Supreme Court said in the Yoder case that the essence of all is what has been said or written on the subject is only those interests of the highest order and those not otherwise served can overbalance these kind of claims. And so of a fundamental right. And what that means is that when the government has an interest in protecting a child against child abuse, for example, or child neglect, that the government has a compelling government interest. And so that fundamental right must give way to that compelling interest of the government protecting the child against physical abuse. And so on the other hand, if government came in and said that you could not speak certain topics or speak on certain, give certain viewpoints, you know, that would be a fundamental interest. But if it was something as simple as a pooper scooper law, that you don't have that same, high level of scrutiny that is given to the government action. So be happy to answer any questions, but I hope that answers the compelling interest question.
Representative Coulter.
So I think that was helpful on my previous question, but that was not the question I was asking right now. I'll try and summarize it a little bit more clearly here. Basically, my question is, based on the language in the lines that I referenced, this protects parents' rights both to avoid government from making decisions for their kids on healthcare, like healthcare and other decisions, and in sort of on both sides of that, that it unless there is this compelling state interest, the government could not either direct a certain course of care, for example, or override a parent's choice on a certain course of care. I'm trying to be as clear as I can. I hope that was clear. Am I correct in understanding that it's sort of both sides of that?
Correct.
Okay, thank you. So unless there is some demonstrable compelling interest from the state, that would protect the right to seek, for example, gender-affirming care, correct?
Can you restate that again?
So unless,
you know,
I'm with all due respect, my question is to the bill.
I'm just going to reset this. Yeah, I should have. Oh, how did I miss an opportunity for that? Representative Coulter, we're just crossing wires here. Go ahead and just start however you wish.
So my question was, unless this compelling state interest is demonstrated, if this bill were to become law, that would protect a parent's right to ensure that their child receives gender-affirming care, correct?
Representative Gilman.
So, Chair, and thank you, Representative Coulter, could I have Will Wagner weigh in on this as well, please?
William Wagner, via Zoom.
The answer is the parental rights, fundamental right, belongs to all citizens and all parents. And so a parent certainly could assert that parental right in the context of what you just talked about. But the state also could argue that there was a compelling interest against providing that kind of care like they've done in Europe. And so it would certainly make for an interesting court case.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you. Well, I think that answers my question, and it sounds like the answer is yes. So what I will say just in closing here is, as I mentioned, I'm a parent of two young kids, and I firmly believe that parenthood is the most personal journey that I have ever been on. And that began from the moment I knew I was going to become a parent to when we had to make the decision to have a C-section, because apparently my wife and I make babies with gigantic heads. and it continues on. And so I absolutely appreciate the fundamental belief and nature of a parent being a parent. And my concern often when we see proposals like this is, I understand that notion of wanting to be able to be a parent, but my worry is that when the goal is to take power away from the government, in this case, that instead we are putting that power in the hands of other parents. Not just the power in our own hands, but in the power into the hands of other parents. And I'm going to be careful about getting too emotional here, but your rights as a parent do not extend to making decisions for my own kids. And this is where I think we get to a place where I have some serious problems with this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Emotions are always welcome in this committee as long as they're not too loud. We'll go to Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Gilman, in reading your bill, does it prohibit teaching manners in school or how to cross a road safely or calling 911?
Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative McDonald. This bill does not do that. In fact, those are common sense things that I would hope, and I know that our teachers are doing, along with amazing paraprofessionals, and that would not be an infringement on them being taught manners in school.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, the reason I ask that is because it was stated by our vice chair or co-chair that it did just that, and I think we need to be careful not to exaggerate or elaborate on a bill. The state has done wonderful and very important work in protecting children's rights. And I think as far as the state statutes goes in 260C, I question that as well, that should it belong in that area. Because we've done such a, we're not perfect as human beings, but many legislatures long before any of us got here has done magnificent things in protecting children. Mm-hmm. But so too, we got to protect the parents' rights as well. We would be negligent if we put into state statute protections from children and not protections from parents. I think it's very logical and necessary. Unfortunately, it's necessary. We don't all abide by what is right and wrong. The best thing this committee could do is to ensure that children are safe. from harmful adults or other children. But so, too, we need to protect our parents. We have our rights as well. Mm-hmm. And just as far as being in that section 260, I question whether it should be in there, but I think it might belong in there, and here's why. And it's a work in progress. But under 260.001, subsection 1, if you look down to item number 2, it deals with permanency matters, including termination of parental rights. Now, can you imagine if you're a parent and you've done the best you can do? My priority is to be the best parent and husband ever. That trumps anything I do. So because it states in 260C, in that section of 2, of terminating parental rights, perhaps we should have a section that identifies what parents' rights are. It's unfortunate in this day and age we have to even put into law what a parent's rights is. Mm-hmm. But we are folks that fall short of the glory of God. And that's why we have protections for children, for protections from the elderly, protections from the disabled, from the downtrodden, from homelessness. And two, it makes sense that we should protect the parents because there's outside forces that want to take and probably raise our children best, they think, better than a parent. Mm-hmm. And I think we cannot let government get in the way of allowing a parent to be the best educator. Just as much government is necessary to protect children from harmful individuals. That was the only question I had, Representative Gilman. The comment as far as the placement of the bill to protect parents. The language has some really very pertinent information to protect our parents, so we know what's best to raise our children. And in that section of 260, it also has very specific state statutes to protect the children. And for those who will harm our children, they will pay the price. This is a good bill. As you said, Representative Gilman, it's a work in progress. I hope that everyone on this committee believes not only protecting children is important, but so too is protecting the parents. There are renegade folks that want to take our children away from us. We've heard in other stories in the news, and this will do to protect the parents. Nothing's perfect, but it's a good start, and for that, I support your bill, Representative Gilman.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Chair West. And I just wanted to clarify my comments, said that I was concerned that it could be interpreted as. I was not insinuating that.
Recording stop. Recording in progress.
Is he recording this? No. House info. Sorry.
Okay. House information. Hello. Thank you for joining the chat.
Sorry.
So just to clarify, that was not my intention, but I understand the intent. Please do not think I do not understand your intent. As a single mother who wants nothing more than to keep my decisions with me and not the fathers of my children who have abandoned them, I like what you're thinking. I like where your head is at. My challenge is that I think you're also in a little bit over your head in the child protection world, and that's what I'm trying to help with. This is a very complicated area of law. In the scenario I gave you earlier, for example, that child would need to be taken, like the county would need to take action to potentially override both parents, and we'd actually have more government interference in that situation because this would potentially require both parents to consent to the medical examination, right? So if the goal is to like get them out of that, this is a really complicated area of law to navigate. And so I don't disagree with what's been said at all. I just think that there's a lot more expertise that needs to be applied to really pull this through. I just don't think this bill is ready for prime time yet. And I think that's the most important thing to take away. You've got a lot more work to do and a lot of stakeholders to talk to, county protection social workers, Department of Children, Youth, and Families. I mean, you got a list. So you should work that and really think about every scenario. And remember, child protection laws are designed to protect our children, yes. And most parents are good parents, but the ones that are bad are awful a lot of times, right? These are people who want to circumvent our laws so that they can do what they want, which is hurt kids, some of them. And it's not the common all the time situation, but we must, as legislators,
make sure that we are preventing for the worst possible case scenario and be careful even with the best intentioned bills, because you would not want that on your conscience to know that we messed up and did something wrong. So that's my statement off my soapbox again.
Representative Hemmingson-Yeager.
Thank you, Chair. And as I look through this, I also serve on the Health Committee, and there's a lot of things in here that I'm a little concerned about, and you might want to talk to people on the Health Committee, if not, maybe bring it before the Health Committee. And it's mostly on page 2, but it talks about physical samples.
Representative Hemmingson, this will have go to the Health Committee.
Oh, excellent.
I'd hate to interrupt you, but.
Okay. So then you know all the pieces that go to health. Fantastic. I do draw a little bit of concern because in a former life, I actually worked in a clinical lab. And so there's some things talking about like samples from blood, DNA stored, tested. And I know you later on say that, you know, in the event of a medical emergency or life-threatening, the one thing that brought to my mind, and this is one of many tests that can be done, is a newborn screening test. And newborn screening tests for, I think there are over 60 different congenital disorders now that are treatable and have interventions that you can do. However, at the time that they are presenting, they are not necessarily life-threatening. So my concern is that if some of these diagnostic tests are not done because healthcare is complicated, healthcare is complex, and when you're like post-delivery, there's a lot happening. Mm-hmm. And without that information, parents may not know what's going on, and they may be sending their kids home, and the kid has cystic fibrosis, the kid has fetal kidalneuria, other things where it's like if there's not an intervention right away, the accumulation of that disorder will present, and then it will become life-threatening, where if you had done the intervention sooner, and this is a little genetic soapboxy, we can do those interventions sooner, we can prolong long, healthy lives. So we'd love to talk to you more about it, and but yeah, I just kind of want you really to think about some of that aspect of it too.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you so much, Representative, for bringing that forward. Again, I would love to talk offline with you about this before it goes to the next stop. It still ultimately will go back to the parents' decisions on what they are choosing to do for their children through having their rights also be considered. If they want to opt out of testing or opt out of something other than life-saving measures and things like that, I believe that this is something that, again, goes back to the parent's decision. Thank you.
Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Gilman, for bringing this to the committee. And this is something, you know, it's really heartbreaking to read through the testimonials, you know, to hear of problems happening in the medical facilities by doctors, by children being left alone at 12 and 13 years old. And what I'm hearing here in the committee is that everyone agrees, it sounds like, you know, that we want to do what's right for these children, and that is including that we have to bring parents back into this equation, which for whatever reason in the last few years, the parents have really been excluded medically and for some reason. And I heard over here this comment that he would be afraid of the power being taken away from the government. And that is a startling statement to make, that we would take away power from the parents and give that to the government. So I just want to, again, thank you for bringing this and want to support you moving forward with this and really encourage the people that have these good suggestions, and we all have the same goal in mind. Don, just my question to you is, you're available and you want to work together on all of these things to make sure that this bill is getting through, because not doing anything is not an option when we're seeing the rights being taken away from the parents. So just wanted to make sure that you're able to work with everyone to fix these things that they have the concerns with.
Representative Gilman?
Yes, Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative. And again, I'm very encouraged by the conversations, the different aspects and things to consider as we move this through. And it's not about just moving something through. We want it to be the best version, again, to have things go forward. So I welcome any and all conversations with members in this room and anybody else that you think I should be in touch with. I would love to meet with stakeholders. And thank you for those suggestions. It means a lot to me.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair. Thank you, Representative Gilman. Everybody's been talking about the government, and that's great. I'm a little bit more concerned about, like, the healthcare providers, because, as you know, I've raised a bazillion children, including quite a few teenagers, including some that, contrary to, you know, some of the things that have been said today, I feel like they are still my children, even though I did not birth them. But I really appreciate that being brought up all the time. It's the way to be a parent. Parenting teenagers and healthcare decisions is a little bit different from parenting kiddos, like little ones, and especially from my lens, parenting children who maybe have had other parents first. Mm-hmm. And the way that this is written, especially when it looks at the mental health stuff, I'm really concerned that a child, if they knew that their parents could tap into their mental health record when they were 16, 17, even 15, may not talk to a therapist. There's a lot of really big feelings for adolescents, especially adolescents who have been a part of trauma. And to be clear, I would never tap into my kids' mental health records, regardless if there was a law or not, because I actually believe that they are autonomous human beings who have a right to privacy, especially at the age of 15, 16, 17. I really, really believe that 15, 16, 17-year-olds should be able to have private conversations with therapists and doctors that are none of my business. I also don't think they're any of their father's business, to be fair. And my girls would tell you, thank God. Anyway, I would never do that. But I have really big concerns about kids who end up in a different, whose parents maybe feel differently about that. And if that prevents someone from saying, you know, I have a substance use problem because they haven't told their parents and they've been hiding it. And the school counselor, you know, asks, do you need some resources? How are you, you know, I'm concerned. Don't know if you're using marijuana, but when you left the bathroom, I smelled something, right? And the child knows that that person is going to have to tell their mom right away. And then they don't tell them. And then they don't get help. And we end up down a path that is terrifying to me as someone who has dealt with teens and substance use. And so I don't have a solution. Because the way that this is written, a child that's 5 is treated the same as a child that's 17 and 11 and a half months. And so I have concerns about that because I do think as children age, we have to give them autonomy. They need to be able to do those things. Otherwise, all of a sudden they're 18 and it's like, oopsie, figure out how to do all the stuff, right? And so I would just encourage you to think about the difference between 7 and 17 and what, if any, changes could be made to account for that and where you're willing to be flexible in that space. If, as you said previously, if it's true it's a parent's decision all the time from birth to the 18th birthday, and that's your stance, then I don't think there's a solution. If you're willing to move from that stance to maybe we need to teach teenagers differently, I'd be happy to have that conversation. So I guess my question to you is, are you willing to have that conversation, or is 17 and 11 and a half months the same as 7 in this bill and in your philosophy that came with writing it? Mm-hmm.
I'd like to praise the committee for being very respectful, and we can disagree without being disagreeable. I am just thrilled with how we're having a reasonable discussion, given how some other committees may or may not have gone. Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you so much, Representative Hicks. Again, the definition of minor is 17 and under, and I would welcome conversation. I'd welcome conversation around that. But I also understand that, for example, I have 5 kids, you know, and I know that not all kids are created equal. And I myself have experienced things. And knowing that mandated reporters, like a youth pastor or somebody like that, hear something, or a counselor hears something, there is a mandated reporting that's supposed to be happening, especially if it's around abuse, you know, substance use, things like that. So I would want a parent to be brought into that conversation. And again, if a parent is the one committing an act or a family member committing an act that's a crime, I would want that to be fully exposed and help my child through that situation. I don't believe, as Representative Coulter mentioned earlier, I wouldn't want another parent or another person instructing my child how to navigate through very difficult things. And I appreciate your perspective on that, though. Thank you.
Representative Nelson. Vice Chair Nelson. The Honorable Representative Vice Chair Nelson.
That was not why I didn't answer right away. I saw you looking over in that way, and I was expecting like Nadeau or something, and it was not what I heard come out of your mouth. So, no, that's not a problem. So, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for this bill coming forward. And as a parent that has five children of my own and I've got a grandchild, you know, seeing the kids grow up, you know, it's such an honor to be a parent. I think it's probably one of the greatest gifts. Representative Coulter, you get a very different perspective on life when you have children. And I remember holding my first child in my arms and I didn't realize I could love something that much. And it's got a new parent right over here. And it's an absolute, unless you're a parent, I don't know if you can describe it. You maybe come close, but and as that, I think it's the intent of this bill, and I think of maybe some of where it's trying to be taken aren't in the same direction. You know, I see the intent of this bill as being, you know, somebody that is a parent that wants to be involved in their children's lives and their upbringing, and probably have correct boundaries, and also being able to advocate for their children in the way they feel best. I think we've heard that in the testimony. Now, there's also, unfortunately, circumstances we've heard of the other side, you know, where parents have been terminated of their rights for correct reasons, for abuse, for neglect, for things like that. And, you know, what gets difficult is when we have a bill like this and looking at all of those things through this lens, and it really gets fuzzy to try to figure this out. So, Representative Gilman, I thank you for bringing this bill forward. I thank you for taking the questions. I know that I've sat in that seat before and it's not easy to do, but it's a lot of questions that need to be asked and need to be answered. I think that you're probably very willing to work on this and to make it the best bill that's possible and to, support the rights of parents, support the rights of, and ultimately giving the best life that child can have. And I think that should be the goal of this. And, you know, when I look as myself as a parent, my wife and I have been, you know, the primary caregivers of our children. And then, you know, we've partnered with the school. We've also done some homeschool, but, you know, our kids go to school. They're, you know, so we partner with them in education. We partner with our church in religious training. You know, it kind of... As much as I hate the phrase, it takes a community, it does. And at the same time, I think it really comes back to the parents. You know, Susanna and Nathan Nelson are the primary people that are responsible for my children until they're not minors anymore. And, you know, I think, you know, with that, I think it is reasonable to have rights for parents. Is there things in this bill that might need to be addressed? Could be. But I think we need to have this discussion on it. And I think the question I would have is for the nonpartisan research, is there a better chapter of law for this to be under, or is this, and maybe that's something that you don't have to answer right away, but, maybe that's where it should be, but I thank you for the discussion today, and I think that'll wrap up my comments on it.
Representative Censor Mira. We're done.
Thank you. Can everyone hear me? Okay, great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Gilman, for bringing this bill. It's a little bit hard because I can't see you, so it makes it a little bit awkward to be in conversation, to be asking questions. I can't see the author of the bill. I can see the committee members. But I want to thank you for bringing this bill. I think we're wading into really tricky territory, and I do, you know, this is something that I think we will need to have conversations about this year. You know, I sit on the education committee. You know, I know that we are looking at some of the opt-out laws and thinking about, do we need to change or tweak those to better kind of meet the moment that we are in? But I do have concerns that I think have been shared here about kind of some of the really what I would say broad or general phrasing of the bill. And so I kind of want to talk through a scenario that I think is actually a pretty real scenario that we are seeing in our schools and you know, kind of ask you with your intentions, how would this language affect this scenario? You know, what I think we were talking about is we're talking about the rights of children, we're talking about the rights of parents, and we're also talking about the rights of families. And I think where this gets tricky is sometimes where it seems like the rights of one family might intersect or be in misalignment with the rights of another family. So the scenario that I want to talk about is, you know, I have heard a concern of people saying, you know, I'm worried that in schools, or it could be even preschools, let's say daycares, right, that there's a concern that people are, that young people are learning about sexuality too early. And when I have kind of dug into what this means, you know, I have heard that for some people, they feel like sexuality can be represented in just a different type of family, right? So let's say, at a kindergarten class, I'm a teacher. I ask people to do portraits of their families, and one student draws a portrait that has two moms, right? I have heard people characterize that as learning about sexuality because you are learning about a non-heterosexual relationship. And I worry that in the wording of this bill, the vagueness would potentially mean that a student who has two moms draws a picture, draws a family portrait of that, is not able to put that portrait up on the wall, is not able to represent their family, be proud of their family at school because of the vagueness of the wording of, you know, parents have a right to direct the education of the minor child, whether it be public, charter, private, or home education. They have the right to direct the upbringing of the minor child, direct the moral or religious training of the minor child. So I think we all agree that families have rights, but there are places in a public sphere where those rights can come into conflict with each other, right? Whether it is you are not vaccinating your child, and so it's potentially making my child less safe, or whether it's, you know, your religion does not believe in the foundation of someone's family. How do we think through some of those things? So in that specific scenario that I talked about where, you know, a young person wants to represent their family has two moms that might be, not aligned with someone else's religious belief, under the wording of your bill with these parental rights, how would we think through that situation?
Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you so much, Representative, for your question. Again, you referenced a scenario in a kindergarten classroom. Again, I believe there are clear differences with being taught sexual education, meaning like a sex ed curriculum, versus having somebody draw their family tree. I'll just speak from experience. When my son, two of my sons, had to draw their family tree in school. Both of my boys are adopted. They're African American, Guyanese, East Indian. And that was difficult. It was challenging. So that family tree was challenging for them because they didn't know where it went, part of their family tree went. I don't believe under this bill and how this is worded would present anything that would be going against the parental bill of rights in the sense of this is people's situation, this is their family situation. So it's one thing to have curriculum introduced, surveys introduced that would take students down a path versus people expressing who they are in their family of origin. And so I would hope that that would be fostered in love and respect. And if conversations go forward, spin out from what the kids are learning and seeing in their classroom. That's where, you know, it's a phone call. If things go into a, you know, training or education, this is part of their life story, and I would hope that there would be love and acceptance in that classroom.
Representative Sinsemira, do you have a follow-up?
Yeah, just one quick follow-up. You know, I would love to hear a little bit about the stakeholder engagement that has been done about this bill. I mean, I really appreciate that answer, Representative Gilman. You know, I'm glad that at the core you believe that all young people can be, you know, and all families deserve to be represented in educational spaces. But, you know, thinking through the stakeholder engagement, I'm wondering, you know, what kind of families, what kind of parents have been engaged around this bill? Have queer families been engaged around this bill? Have single moms been engaged around this bill? If you can just talk a little bit about, you know, the kinds of families that have engaged in looking at this, because to me, that's a real scenario that could come up. To me, that's a potential that this bill could be weaponized to hurt families. And so just want to make sure that we are having those diverse voices at the table as we craft this legislation.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative. Again, I think as this continues to move through, I am open to any and all conversations with as many stakeholders as possible. My immediate family has queer and gay folks that are represented well, and I would love to run this by them. And thank you for bringing that forward. I want to put as much time and energy into this as possible, and thank you for bringing that forward to me. Thanks.
Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't really going to talk on this bill, but I really appreciate the approach that you brought this forward with, Representative Gilman. And I appreciate the fact that everyone has a different view. Most of us are parents, not all of us. I think we're all perfect parents. in the way that we approach our children. We have different kids at different ages, and we grow, we learn. As these children grow. But I think the most important thing that I'm picking up here is that there's this general willingness to try to find the balance, and that you're open to it. And I like that. There's parts of this bill I'm not fond of. I'm glad that you're willing to, you know, keep working on these and listening to the concerns that people have. But what's not confusing is that you're trying to get as close as you possibly can to eliminating the disparity between what trumps. Is it government or is it parents? And I think most people here are in agreement that parents need to be, you know, at the peak, at the top of this thing. Vulnerable adults, be it or children, you know, there's consent everywhere. There's parental and guardian consent in school. There's sign off for children's mental health services in school-based mental health provision. I mean, it's permeated through here, and none of what you're doing in this bill makes it simpler for the complexities of the families that are out there. There's nothing that we can do here that's going to make that easier. So I think that your focus on trying to stay at a high level, making parents be the pinnacle of that, I think is the right approach. And I appreciate everyone here's willingness to try to contribute to the finality moving this thing forward. So with that, thank you, and I want to thank members of this committee and the chair for making sure that we've had this a really good conversation. So thanks very much.
Thank you.
Chair Katizwa-Tum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Gilman, I appreciate you bringing this bill forward. I think it's a really important conversation. And to echo Chair West, I mean, I think that we have done a really great job so far of having a really civil conversation on which could potentially be a really tough topic to talk about, right? In your opening statement, you had mentioned that nothing in this bill is necessarily new or that parents don't already have the right to do. And I'm curious if you know, here in the legislature last session, we had over 5,000 bills introduced, so it's really hard to keep track on what may or may not be amongst our committee jurisdiction. So I'm curious if there are active efforts that you're aware of to legally restrict some of these rights that you feel that parents should have in statute.
Representative Gilman.
Okay, I'm trying to Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative. I'm just trying to condense. What is your question again at the end here, if you don't mind?
Chair Katizwatu.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just trying to wrap my head around if there are active efforts here at the legislature to restrict the rights of parents in terms of what you've listed here in this proposal.
Representative Yeoman.
Thank you so much, Chair, and thank you so much, Representative. The reason this bill is coming forward is because of concerns and because of the rights that have been restricted of parents being a part of the process. And if you'd like examples, we can definitely talk offline about some of those to save time. But this is coming forward because there has been an infringement on parental rights. And that's where having them be a part of the conversation and deeper conversations would be really helpful for the health and safety of the children. That's why this is here.
Chair Katizwatu.
Thank you. I think that that's helpful. I'm just trying to clarify whether or not there's actual active legal efforts happening to restrict the rights of parents at the legislature versus, you know, perhaps a parent feels left out of a conversation at school and they think, oh, I should really be in that conversation and I'm disappointed or frustrated that I wasn't included in that conversation. The school isn't actually saying you can't be included in the conversation. So I hope that that kind of makes a little bit more sense. I'm also curious, and partly it connects to my first question, how this bill would interplay with some of our other existing fundamental rights that are currently in state statute, such as the PRO Act.
Representative Gilman.
Again, I thank you so much, Chair, and thank you, Representative. That is a great question, and I would love to understand the process piece of it legally. I'm not a lawyer, and so we could definitely talk to the lawyers about that piece of it, how that would marry or how that would look. But fundamentally, parents need to be a part of the conversation. So if you would like a legal description, I would love to invite Will Wagner to respond to that. Otherwise, we can definitely kind of...
In the interest of time, I'm going to have... If Chair Katizwatu wants that, we can do that, but we're running short of time here. Chair Katizwatu.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do understand, and I'm willing to follow up with one of the numerous lawyers here in our body that aren't on this committee. So that it is connecting to my initial question about restriction of rights and whether or not there are active efforts to do so. And I mention this in connection to the PRO Act because in the Health Committee this afternoon, they're hearing a bill to restrict the rights of people to choose to terminate their pregnancy. And so there are active efforts to restrict our existing fundamental rights that we have in law. And I don't know of any active proposals that would not allow parents to direct the education of their minor child or access, review, and oversee the privacy of all school records or direct the upbringing of their child. I just don't see the legislature moving in that direction. And it feels like this, while some additional oversight may be necessary and while parents might have to go out of their way in certain circumstances, that I don't necessarily agree that they should have to do that. But I don't know that we have to defend rights in statute that aren't actively being taken away. I know that you have a really big heart, and I think, you know, some of the advocacy that you've done for your own children, whether, you know, your adopted children, you're talking about the I've had the same conversation with my adopted kids about their family tree, and it can be a little tricky. But then also some of the other work outside the legislature that might have even catapulted your drive to run for office. And I think that when you said that you want to link arms with teachers and you want to link arms with health professionals and link arms with folks, I see that that is an earnest desire. I don't know that this bill is how we go about that. So, again, I appreciate the conversation. I think we've brought up a couple different committees. I know it's going to go to ed policy. I know it's going to go to health. I'm wondering if the bill somewhere on its path is going to stop in judiciary, simply because of some of the conversations about health privacy and those sorts of things. So I think that there's still work to be done. But, again, I appreciate the conversation.
Thank you. Representative Gilman.
Thank you so much.
All righty. Seeing no further discussion, I appreciate the very thorough discussion we've had. That has been the pinnacle of respect, and I am genuinely proud of our committee. I will renew my motion to re-refer House File 22 to the Committee on Education Policy. Also, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed?
No.
No.
The motion prevails. And the bill is on its way. Thank you, Representative Gilman. Now, and we do have a beautiful 10 minutes. So,
10 minutes?
Yeah, hey, I believe in you.
I think we can snap right through this. Don't you think, Chair?
That took all of 4 seconds to get to the snap. So, we'll pay out those bets later. So, I was a little generous on time with the previous testifiers. I didn't anticipate that it would take quite so long, to be honest. So I'm going to be slightly more vigilant about the solid 2 minutes. I was doing 2 minutes and 22 seconds for the previous testifiers. We're going to try and keep it to 2 minutes for these so we can stay within 10 minutes. And I will stop talking so we can get to it. So,
awesome.
Chair Katiza Batum, would you like to move the bill? Oh, you're a member. You can move your own dang bill.
Yeah. Hi.
I apologize. Well, I'm going to be quiet now.
Chair.
Go nuts.
Yeah.
Representative Perez Vega.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also appreciate. I was going to do an oral amendment, but I've seen that you made an exception to accept the amendment 15 minutes after I didn't have to move it as an oral amendment. So I appreciate that, members of the committee. I'm here to present. That amendment to modify the appropriation from $1 million.
Representative Perez-Vick, could you move your bill, please?
Oh, yes. I'd like to move HF 45, but I have an A1 amendment that's unlisted.
All right. Now you can move.
Thank you. Back. It's just quickly here to modify the bill's appropriation from $1 million to $500,000 per fiscal year. At this time, I'd also just want to kind of get a head start since we're cutting to maybe bring the testimonials if they want to sit down next to me. While I present the HF 45, which is to restore funding for the state SNAP outreach grant program in the next biennium, helping to avoid a funding cliff at a time when more Minnesotans than ever are experiencing food insecurity. The program was created by the legislature in 2023 to support the work of organizations across the state, helping enroll eligible individuals in SNAP. Originally funded at $1 million a year, for fiscal year 24 and 25, funding is now cut in half to $500,000 a year starting in fiscal year 26 to 27. For our great new department that we heard from yesterday, DCYF, and eligible organizations to prepare for fiscal 25 grant process. Funding must be restored in the 2025 legislative session, which is why this legislation is a priority for Second Harvest Heartland, who's joining me here today, and other SNAP outreach organizations from my district that are here as well. Don't want to take too much of the time. I've got the pros right next to me, and I, at this time, would like to offer their testimony to you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Perez Vega, we will get to testimony real briefly, but first I will move your A1 amendment, and all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? The amendment is adopted. The motion prevails. Now, whichever testifier would like to
start. I'd like to invite Mesa, who's here again. Thanks for being here again this year. On behalf of Second Harvest. Gracias. Go ahead.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chair West and members of the committee. My name is Mesa Siebert, and I am the Neighbor Services Outreach Manager at Second Harvest Heartland Food Bank. We are pleased to support HF 45, which will support organizations across the state that provide education, information, and assistance to Minnesotans applying for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. SNAP dollars are largely spent at local grocery stores, markets, and small businesses. And for every one meal our food bank provides, SNAP can provide 9. It's the most efficient anti-hunger program in the country. But too many are unaware of its benefits or unable to access it. In fact, Minnesota ranks 35th in the nation, 35th out of 50 states in SNAP participation for eligible people. Even Wisconsin is beating us, coming in at 11th place. Ultimately, we are leaving federal dollars on the table. Dollars which are largely spent in local communities and benefit local businesses and boost economies. I manage a SNAP outreach team, and we are one of about 29 other SNAP outreach grantees in the state. Together, we cover all 87 Minnesota counties. And my team helps inform and educate Minnesotans on all things SNAP related. We explain the complex 10-page SNAP application combined form. And we help break down stigma. We help address policy changes and answer questions as well. And in 2024, my team conducted over 200 outreach events in Minnesota. They helped drive more than 17,000 inquiries to our care center, and we were able to assist 8,500-plus Minnesotans with SNAP, an increase of 20% over 2023. However, there are still many barriers standing between our county, our community members and SNAP access. We need to fund local organizations who have unique insight and understanding of their immediate communities and can support these efforts. So HF 45 would address this by avoiding a SNAP outreach funding cliff this summer. And we respectfully ask for your support. Thank you so much.
Thank you. At this time, I have a testimony from Janet Gracia, who's the president of the Neighborhood House organization in District 65B.
Ms. Gracia, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much. My name is Janet Gracia, and I serve as the president and CEO of Neighborhood House. We provide basic needs to people on a variety of different areas, but certainly one of our most used program is food security and food support. The need for food support in our community is greater than ever. From last year to this year's program year, Neighborhood House has distributed over 47% more food than we did the previous year, and we do not see that slowing down. On a daily basis, I see individuals, families, teens, really suffering from food security, and I see that on a daily basis. And I think that regardless of where we stand, we all agree that we do not want to see anyone in Minnesota go hungry. At Neighborhood House, we meet families where they are. We offer a food market. We have fresh produce pickups and offer additional essential services. We have a dedicated individual who helps people navigate accessing SNAP benefits when they are eligible. We have many people come into our food market who are experiencing that food insecurity and do not know that they are eligible for this type of benefit, or they do not have any idea how to access that benefit. Currently, I think it's nice to hear, or interesting to hear stories. Our person who does the SNAP navigation at Neighborhood House, when I asked her, I said, why did you seek out Neighborhood House? Why are you doing this work? She said that she, as a young child, helped her parents navigate coming to our food market, getting the support, helping her parents at 12 years old fill out forms.
I hate to interrupt, but if you could wrap up in 2 minutes.
Okay.
We only have like 4 minutes left.
Right.
So.
Okay. So I just want to share just the importance of these children helping families navigate. We know that poverty is a daily reality for the people we serve. 62% of all participating households.
You're coming out of the next testifier's time at this moment.
Okay, I will stop, but I am just going to say that I fully support this bill and feel that it will make our communities better for all of us. Thank you.
Apologize for the interruption.
Last testimony here on this bill, Chair, is going to Yvette Isaiah Martinez from Greater Twin Cities United Way.
Ms. Martinez, please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair West and members of the committee. My name is Yvette Isaiah Martinez, and I serve as Senior Officer of Advocacy at Greater Twin Cities United Way. I will skip the introduction of the organization for brevity, but I would like to share that in 2024, through our statewide helpline 211, Greater Twin Cities United Way made 15,000 referrals related to food security statewide. This represents a 4% increase from the numbers of referrals provided in 2023. Notably, about 2,000 of those referrals come from outside of the Twin Cities metro area, noting that this is not just a Twin Cities metro area problem, this is a Minnesota problem. Overall, in the past 3 years, through our 211 line,
We have noted 57% increase in referrals related to food and food access and food security. These are not phone calls specific to SNAP because those are tracked differently. This highlights the need that we have for programs and outreach to ensure that every Minnesotan that is eligible and that is facing food insecurity can access the benefits, know that it exists, and they can stay fed, healthy, and thrive.
Thank you.
Representative Perez Vega, any? All right, we almost had a testifier, but they're right. Very respectful about the committee's time. Representative McDonald, member questions.
Mr. Chair, just real quickly, Representative Perez Vega, I didn't hear why that you are going from a, other than financial, but from $1 million to 500,000.
Well, you know, due
to... Representative Perez Vega.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're being reasonable right now with our state's budget, right? And I think we've all can come to talk about what those tails and those numbers look like. And there's also the federal funding bag of $250,000 to match is right there. And this is an opportunity of nonpartisan gathering here to feed Minnesotans. In fact, SNAP feeds over 435,000 Minnesotans. So I'm appreciative of... Senora Martinez here talking about the fact that this is not just a metropolitan area, that this is serving all of our Minnesotans, and why not take some federal funding that's on the table when we all know it could be frozen up pretty soon here.
Representative McDonald?
Yeah, that's all. Thank you. Actually, for the record, I was, in favor of the full amount, personally.
Well, thank you.
I understand.
Well, we could always come back.
Come on back.
Yeah.
Come on back to Legacy. I'll help you out.
I think my co-chair and I get nervous when members like to spend all our target time. All righty. We are headed to a tough budget situation, and we got to make sure we pay attention to that, which is why the bill will be laid over. There is one more member question with Representative Ndo.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just quickly, so based on the testimony that I've heard, and this money is all for outreach, correct? None of these dollars are actually going to serve people. I mean, they're just for outreach programs. So I appreciate the fact that you've lowered the number because I think that you know we've built a lot of capacity in our outreach programs, and based on the testimony that I've heard, the real need is in more money for food supports, not more outreach. So can you just spend some time as quickly talking about that? I would much prefer $500,000 to go to actual food supports for family.
Representative Perez Vega, I actually had the same question.
I would like to present here back to Mesa, who can answer that snappier than me right now, but go ahead.
All right.
Yes. Thank you, Chair. I was just going to say that we help people apply for SNAP. That's what we do. So we're helping them access those benefits. It would be wonderful if we could just give them all the money in the world to buy their own groceries, and I would really like that to be the case. However, it's not an easy system to navigate. This is a 10-page combined application form that they have to fill out to get SNAP. So we have to help interpret this, explain it, and guide them through that. We have to follow up with other things after the fact as well, proof of identification, proof of income, proof of earnings, all of these other follow-ups. We have to help them navigate that whole process. So what we're doing is educating and informing somebody how to empower themselves into navigating this as well. It's not a one-time call and apply and you're done. This is a training on how to access and navigate this for an individual to empower them to go on and do this themselves and maybe empower their neighbor to do it as well.
Representative Ndo.
And just one final follow-up. How many years have you been doing this education and outreach program?
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. I've been doing this for 5 years with Second Harvest Heartland Food Bank. Prior to this, I was in federal programming with Social Security Disability.
All righty, Perez Vega, Representative Perez Vega, I apologize. Any closing comments?
Yes, I just want to say Minnesota families are growing crisis due to the rising cost of living. Nutrition food is a basic necessity. My experience with a chronic illness like type 1 diabetes has shown me how essential access to healthy food is and how the situation can be for those facing food insecurity. For some Minnesotans, it could be a matter of life and death, and I feel that this is a opportunity to keep our fridges full and get families knowing how they can have those beautiful resources and reliable access to healthy, nourishing meals. With that, I don't really have much more to say other than let's snap this out, Chair.
Roger that. And I will lay this over for possible inclusion in a omnibus bill. Members will be meeting next Tuesday, and it'll be a good time then, too. Thank you for everybody being very respectful. The meeting is adjourned.